Therefore, I know no positive example of the US presence in the world to have brought security.
It's understandable. While the traveler will muddy waters to catch his fish, residents would opt for protecting their waters for sanitation and sustainable use. Even with selfish intentions, Iran's interests lie in lack of instability in the region. To establish and maintain all-round relations, especially trade relations with neighboring states, Iran needs the region secure, and it has done something about it, or in some cases made recommendations for sustainable stability and security in West Asia or the Middle East. Iran has constantly been in the spotlight for its considerable influence in the five states, Iraq, Syria, Afghanistan, and Yemen. And also, the Palestinian issue is of great consequence to Iran, both geostrategically and for humanitarian reasons. Before getting into each of our five states separately, I'd like to invite you to a quick media review to see what other outlets have to say. Here's how the topic of terror and instability, stability versus instability, looks in other outlets, beginning with China Daily. U.S. duplicity on terrorism, condemnable. Terrorism is the common enemy of all humans, and terrorists have caused great harm to all countries and people around the world. So all countries should treat terrorism and terrorists as potent threats. However, Washington often reacts fiercely to terrorist attacks in the U.S. or its ally countries and stands united with them. Yet when terrorists launch attacks in countries which the U.S. sees as rivals or competitors, it remains indifferent and even tries to use so-called ethnic and or religious problems in these countries to dilute the issue or give it a political twist. Therefore, it is time for the U.S. to abandon double standards on terrorism and stop supporting its favored terror groups. Otherwise, it would also get burned by the fire it has been fanning. We've something from Tehran Times quoting an Indian professor, Ashok Swain, who says the U.S. role in the Middle East or West Asia has never been constructive. Swain, a professor of peace and conflict research at the Department of Peace and Conflict Research from Uppsala University, believes Washington has been seeking its own interests in the region. Its interest has never been for the Middle East security and development, but for its own security and development. The Indian professor says it will not only be difficult, but in many cases impossible for the Biden administration to bring back the mask of a fair adjudicator, which the USA has been wearing for decades. Fars News quotes Iran's top security official, who underlines the necessity of a U.S. pullout from the region. The Secretary of Iran's Supreme National Security Council, SNSC, Ali Shamkhani, stressed that the withdrawal of American forces from the regional states is a necessity. The U.S. has intensified its measures to foment insecurity in West Asia in the past year, and the climax of this behavior was the cowardly assassination of anti-terrorism commanders General Qasem Soleimani and Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis. Shamkhani continued, the Islamic Republic of Iran is determined to take a harsh revenge on the masterminds and perpetrators of this historical crime to stop the U.S. and its agents' continued terrorist and anti-security actions which stir tension in the region and force them to leave the region. And that's what was on offer from other media outlets. Stay with me, for there's more to come. Iran's interest in creating stability in the region. To demonstrate that by example, let's take a look at Iran's stance towards each of five states. In Iraq, Iran seeks stability because it has common economic, security, religious, cultural, and other interests in this country. The U.S. presence in Iraq has killed hundreds of thousands of people so far. And so, in Iran's view, a U.S. presence will not bring peace here on out either. A warring U.S. presence in Iraq began in 2003. And if terror can be separated from invading a country, given the U.S. is at war in the Middle East at large, but says it's fighting its pet terror groups here, why did it assassinate General Soleimani? Soleimani was Iran's frontman against Daesh. Following the Daesh or ISIS surge into northern Iraq over 5 years ago, Iran moved swiftly by arming Iraqi Kurdish fighters and supporting Baghdad with military advisors. It also provided training for Shia militias in a counteroffensive against Daesh. By fighting the relentless terror group, it kept them off European borders even. Had it not been for Iran's confrontation with Daesh, that bloodthirsty group would probably have taken over Baghdad, and its supporters, the United States and Saudi Arabia, would have just continued to hesitate in confronting it.
What the Islamic Republic of Iran wants is to establish security in the Gulf of Oman, the Strait of Hormuz, and the Persian Gulf. Insecurity will benefit nobody. Naturally, we would never like our neighbor's home to be set on fire, because even if the fire does not spread, the smoke will reach us. That's why we prefer the region to be secure and calm. However, hegemonic nations prefer to create insecurity in the region.
Similarly, in Syria, Iran seeks peace and security partly by joining the fight against ruthless terrorist groups. Iran's stance is to stand by the Syrian people, the Aleppo liberation, and establishing a truce as key to establishing peace and stability in Syria.
Iran maintains influence in the region because it makes its own decisions and chooses its own friends. There are two types of influence, legitimate and illegitimate. Legitimate influence is when a country, one of Iran's neighbors or a more distant one, invites us to help it counter terrorism. For example, Syria and Iraq invited us. We do not intend to impose our views on these countries and interfere in the internal affairs of these countries. But because they wanted us to help them and because we have a common security risk, we go ahead and help them as an advisor.
As for Palestine, Iran seeks a peaceful solution to the Palestinian issue, but believes it will not be resolved the way the United States and Israel have in mind, not by expanding illegal Jewish settlements on Palestinian land, by consensus with others, that is. Resistance and referendum is the only viable solution to the Palestinian issue, according to Iran. That is to say, all original Palestinians of any faith displaced anywhere in the world must themselves decide their own fate by referendum. In Afghanistan, Iran seeks stability because with an insecure Afghanistan, the influx of refugees into Iran will increase. Also, drug trafficking towards this country will increase.
They came to Afghanistan 18 years ago saying they wanted to uproot terrorism. But the result today is a tenfold, even 100-fold increase in drug production, growing insecurity in Afghanistan, migration of Afghans to Europe, Iran, and Pakistan. They said they wanted to remove Saddam because of chemical arms which were never unearthed. Today, the Americans themselves, under the pretext of fighting Daesh, have triggered chaos in the entire region.
Iran believes intra-Afghan talks can lead to the process of establishing peace and stability with no need for third parties to interfere in the process. Abdul Ghafur Leval, the Afghan ambassador to Iran, expressed gratitude to this country for its support of the Afghan peace process, establishment of the legitimate government in that country, and hosting Afghan migrants for several decades. Iran's regional presence and intervention is understood, but one country raises eyebrows. I asked for justification to Iran's cooperation in Yemen.
As stated in its constitution, the Islamic Republic of Iran must defend the oppressed in the world. But this defense is legitimate, that is, at the request of those countries. The Yemenis also got help from us. We do not have a military presence in Yemen, but we have an advisory presence. We will help the Yemenis as much as we can and defend the rights of the Yemeni people in the international arena.
Iran calls for an end to Saudi and allied attacks on Yemen, and for Yemenis to decide their own destiny. In doing so, Iran submitted a 4-point Yemen peace plan to the United Nations. The plan announced by Foreign Minister Zarif in 2015 calls for an immediate ceasefire and an end of all foreign military attacks, humanitarian assistance, and a resumption of broad national dialogue and establishment of an inclusive national unity government. The international community will no doubt have to get more effectively involved, as instability has been allowing terrorist groups to gain a foothold in Yemen. I asked, why does the U.S. pursue endless conflict everywhere, especially in West Asia?
Theorists have always said that seizing control of the Middle East is the necessary step towards world domination. One reason is the region's geographical situation that is located on the crossway of three continents. The second reason is the cultural situation. The region is where prophets had their revelations and heavenly books descended. The third and the most important reason is that 60% of the world's energy is supplied from this region. These unique characteristics have made this region a target for great world powers and colonialists, from the United States to Britain and others.
To attempt the more everyday aspects of life and Iran's interest in its regional market. Iran's economy is based on industry and agriculture, and its service sector has been answering its domestic needs because of quality manpower. Now there's an overflow to be exported to regional states, but that requires stability and security in the neighborhood. The U.S. presence is a problem, as are its sanctions. It constantly imposes sanctions on Iran so that other states can't connect to Iranian goods and services. And then the U.S. imposes its own goods and services on those countries. So you can see, it's a constant chain of problems for this country.
If only insecurity would stop at harming the mutual benefit reaped from trade. Lives are being lost and countries are suffering upheaval. And so, Iran seeks U.S. withdrawal from the entire region because it agrees and believes that a U.S. presence will only increase insecurity and provoking public sentiment. It was in May 2020 that the Iranian President Rouhani pointed to problems faced by countries in the region, calling for their cooperation to overcome those problems, which have remained the coronavirus and falling oil prices, security problems, and most importantly, U.S. interference in these countries. His focus was on Iraq at the time. He expressed satisfaction that the political process in Iraq had reached a point when all Iraqi groups and tribes were alongside each other.
That's it for today. Thanks for watching from the whole team. Do return to the box at the same times next week and each week after, as you never know what's on. And don't forget to leave your comments and topic requests. Bye for now.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. السلام عليكم ورحمة الله.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود غده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Foreign enmities and domestic treacheries against self-sufficiency.
This is part of a televised speech delivered on July 31st, 2020 by Ayatollah Khamenei, the supreme leader of the Islamic Revolution, on the occasion of Eid al-Adha.
In the sacred defense era, both Eastern and Western blocs were against us. Both the Soviet Unions of those days and the US and European countries were against us. But we managed to resist without them for 8 years and defeat the enemy. We managed to bring Saddam to his knees and create a disastrous situation for him. We managed to pull this through. In other words, our reliance is on God and on ourselves, but we will make the most of our friends, resources, and potential, God willing. You should also know that there is enmity against domestic capabilities. Some of these enemies are foreign and some are domestic. I will tell you that those who are prepared to import a certain product from foreign markets to create competition inside the country and ruin domestic factories only for the sake of his own personal benefits, this is because they reap some profits from imports, are committing an act of treason. Unfortunately, despite the fact that I stressed this matter before, we still see that some people import certain products from foreign countries while such products are manufactured in the country and they have good quality.
Your light and love policy, nothing more I'd ever want to need. My Lord, protect me from dishonor. Grant me faith to be stronger.
Poor factory owners who have invested in their business with a lot of trouble will not be able to sell their products. we should know that such oppositions and enmities exist inside the country. Since long ago, there has been enmity against domestic independence. More than 150 to 160 years ago, Amir Kabir wanted to make the country's economy and vital capabilities independent. However, with its malice, despicable nature, and temptations that it provoked, the British embassy coerced Nasiruddin Shah into discharging him for chancellery. Later on, they murdered him, which was the English doing.
Alhamdulillah, alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah, all praises to Allah. Alhamdulillah, alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah, all praises to Allah.
Debate. Hello and welcome to Debate. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Thanks so much for being with us. Massive military drills of Iran's Islamic Revolution Guard Corps have come to an end. This after the IRGC has put on quite a show from central Iran to the Indian Ocean. Mock enemy vessels were targeted with long-range ballistic missiles with precision accuracy, hitting targets up to 1,800 kilometers away. Tehran says the maneuvers sent a message to adversaries to avoid attacking Iran, and military officers reiterate that Iran's might is for defensive means only. Stay with us as we take a look at these maneuvers on this debate.
Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps has held a two-day massive military exercise in central Iran. During the drills, codenamed the Great Prophet 15, IRGC destroyed Mach enemy vessels in the Indian Ocean with long-range ballistic missiles. The first stage of the maneuvers kicked off on Friday by firing surface-to-surface ballistic missiles and operating bomber drones. The missiles, equipped with detachable warheads, are guided from outer space and are able to penetrate the enemy's missile shield. On the second day of the drills, the IRGC missiles detected and destroyed the targets as they were sailing 1,800 kilometers away in a remote area in the ocean. The operations were launched in the presence of the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Major General Mohammad Bagheri, who said Iran does not intend to attack any country. However, he said Iranian armed forces will respond with might and promptly in case of any hostile move against the Islamic Republic. The IRGC military exercises started shortly after the Iranian Navy finished its drills in the country's strategic southern waters. The maneuvers are aimed at boosting combat readiness of the Iranian armed forces. The military drills come amid America's stepped-up military threats against Iran in the final days of U.S. President Donald Trump in office. In 2018, the U.S. unilaterally withdrew from the Iran nuclear deal and imposed heavy sanctions on the Islamic Republic. Trump cited Iran's ballistic missile program, among other issues, as the reason. Tehran has time and again said its missile program is strictly for defensive purposes. Like any other country, the Islamic Republic is entitled to boost its defense capabilities.
I'd like to welcome my guests to the program. journalist and historian Brett Yonkers out of Helsinki, and author and journalist Eric Wahlberg out of Toronto. Thank you both for being with us. Well, let's start it off with Brett. Tell us the significance of these latest drills and the timing of them in your perspective.
Well, I think the timing, of course, is of supreme importance here. We're talking about a very dangerous, very volatile time, being the last weeks, the last week now even, of the Donald Trump presidency. We know that Donald Trump is not exactly the most, let's say, held back person, not necessarily the most rational person as well when it comes to international policy in particular. We have seen what he is capable of. We have seen both domestically and in foreign affairs what he can do when he sets his mind to something, and it's not pretty. You know, it's nothing to be proud of. So, of course, for the Islamic Republic of Iran in particular, this is a very dangerous and threatening time. So I think that this is the perfect timing, indeed, to show such an impressive military advancement. We're talking about, according to sources within the Iranian military, that these long-distance ballistic missiles, these missiles that were fired at naval targets, this is a reach that has now been expanded from 300 kilometers in the past to 1,800 kilometers now, which means the Islamic Republic of Iran could fend off a naval aggression over 1,800 kilometers away before they would ever come anywhere near actually reaching the Iranian coast. So this is a very important symbol and a very important signal to make right now, to show that not just the people of the armed forces of Iran are ready to defend their country, but we're also talking about a very modern, high-tech military that has a drone and missile program at the ready in order to defend itself in case of any aggression.
Well, Eric, with what was displayed during the maneuvers and what you've seen, I want to ask you your perspective about the message that it could send and also about the preparedness of Iranian forces.
Well, I agree with Brett. This is a very important step that Iran takes at a very serious, crucial moment when Trump is still threatening and where when Biden is coming to power with promises to de-escalate the tensions with Iran and to return to the JCOA peace, so the nuclear agreement. So I think that it's not an aggressive move. It's quite clearly it's a defensive move, and it's important for this to be point to be made before Biden is pushed by his Zionist backers to try and tell Iran to stop supporting Syria, to stop supporting the Houthis, to stop trying to stop the Israeli-U.S. aggression in the Middle East. That Iran's military might is dedicated to self-defense and to defending its allies in the region, and there's nothing subversive about this. It's all above board. It's all according to international law. And so I'm very comfortable to see these demonstrations, and it is encouraging to know that whereas Israel and U.S. are at the forefront of military production of offensive weapons, that Iran is not going to be held hostage to these clear enemies of peace in the Middle East.
Well, actually, Eric, I want to pick up on what you just said. You said you're very comfortable seeing this. Brett, I want to look at that because, of course, we know how Iran is portrayed by many countries, especially Western countries, trying to show that it's basically a very aggressive country. What Eric just said, that he was comfortable because of showing it's the domestic and also defensive capability as opposed to offensive. I want to look at that aspect of it. Why is it that though Iran has not engaged in an offensive war in 200 years in modern history, it is continually labeled and condemned for being an aggressive nation?
Well, this is all, of course, part of the propaganda mill. Indeed, as Eric pointed out, the Zionist backers behind much of the Western governments, of the so-called leaders of the Western world, the Zionists and the imperialist war hawks, in general, they have an extensive influence in trying to basically beef up these war drums and beef up this war propaganda. And one of their most commonly used phrases, of course, is projection. Is basically one of the most common tactics of projection, that with which I mean everything that the West does wrong is being projected on another country as if it comes from them. The Western powers will say that these other nations are the ones that are potentially imperialist, expansionist, aggressive, colonialist, or neocolonialist, and are a threat to the nations surrounding them. We have seen similar, very clear examples of this in 2018, when Donald Trump made his demands to Iran. These demands include that Iran has to pull back from Iraq, even though they are there with the permission of the Iraqi government. They have to withdraw from Yemen, even though Iran is not involved in Yemen at all. They have to disengage from Syria, even though the Syrian Arab Republic has specifically asked, of course, for Iranian support in their defense against these terrorist movements that are incidentally backed by the West. So they project these sins and these crimes of the West and try to portray it as if it's Iran that does it, as if it's, for example, also the same thing happens with China, the same thing happens with the Democratic People's Republic of Korea. Every time when a nation that is not marching to the beat of the Zionists, to the beat of the imperialists in the West, they are portrayed as these madmen that are running around trying to destroy the world. And indeed, when you look at the situation on the ground, you see that Iran is surrounded on all sides by American bases, American forces, American soldiers, vessels, ships, planes, and the entire cabal of the military industrial complex of the United States, and in many ways also the United Kingdom, France, and much of the European Union, and of course the regional allies and puppet states such as Saudi Arabia. And so these, in order to masquerade what is going on here, the democratic West, as they call themselves, are trying to portray this orientalist image of the basically a return to the old medieval and later Nazi propaganda of the hordes from the East, let's say, that are threatening the democratic West, the civilized West, so to say. This is a tale that has been going on for centuries. And in a modern capacity, we have seen this return time and again. We have seen this happen during the Korean War. We have seen this happen during the Vietnam War. We have seen this during the war against Iraq, the war against Syria, the war against Libya. And this is something that returns over and over again. So this is a psychological warfare, and unfortunately, it has been very, very successful up until recently. Now, fortunately, nowadays we have, of course, the internet and alternative independent media to combat this monopolization of press and monopolization of the written word that has been dominating the West for so long. But it still remains very, very difficult, and this is, of course, why. The Iranian authorities call this the soft war. This is a war of its own, the war of words, the war of truth versus lies, that in many ways is equally important to the actual war of bombs and guns. And this is what is going on here right now, and the war that is being fought in the minds of people every single day.
Okay. Well, Eric, I mean, if we look at, Breck just talked about the war of words. I want to go back to the actual physical war. 40 years ago, of course, when Iran was basically attacked by Saddam Hussein's led Iraq. And of course, Iran trying to get equipment and weapons from everywhere, but basically to no avail with the help of the U.S. and its allies. We fast forward now, 40 years later, more than 40 years later, and we see the type of technology being used, and a lot of this missile technology, homegrown. I want to look at that aspect and the significance of Iran being able to do this under such severe sanctions.
To me, it's a miracle. I every day I think, wow, Iran is fighting the monster, and it's got enough intellectual capability to do that. And that it really is very impressive. I think that if we can get that message out to people, it's not to make people afraid of Iran, it's to make people respect Iran and its attempt to forge an independent and socially just orientation in the international sphere. And I wanted to commend De Vret on his psychoanalysis of the situation that you looked at someone like Trump. He is really psychologically, he's a very seriously tormented individual. And this projection that you see this every day, that people, they're full of hate and they project that hate onto someone else and say, you are the problem. So I think this is on the world scale, we're having a lesson in the human tragedy and the human comedy.
Well, Eric, let me just jump in here, because you talked about as far as Trump and projection. But is this a Trump problem? I mean, if we look at the history of the Islamic Republic of Iran, almost 42 years old now since the revolution, we've seen from the beginning this type of animosity that Washington has had against Tehran, and whether we're talking about a Democrat like Carter or a Republican with Reagan, or we fast forward all the way to Trump, it really hasn't seemed to have changed between the Democrats and Republicans as far as that animosity towards Iran, and actually basically changing the narrative, as Brett has said, what they have done and their aggression, actually trying to show that it has been Iran. Let me throw this to Brett. Go ahead, Brett.
Yeah, this is definitely a key point to make in terms of, you know, American politics. Yes, Donald Trump might be the mad dog of U.S. imperialism in a way, although I highly doubt that Donald Trump is the person who actually came up with things like, you know, assassinating Shahid Qasem Soleimani or the nuclear scientists in Iran who were murdered under his rule. He is more of a person who is, he is the dog let loose, let's say, of the, you know, of U.S. imperialism. Whereas, you know, a person like Obama was a person who could show more restraint and could pretend to be more diplomatic. But in the end, their goals are the same. You know, we should not kid ourselves and believe that the United States under Obama was using the JCPOA for a lasting peace. No, for them, they were hoping that through the JCPOA, they could somehow tame Iran into having, you know, like a velvet counter-revolution, you know, like one of those color revolutions that they've been doing in Eastern Europe ever since the late 1980s. You know, they were probably hoping for something like that. Whereas the war hawks of people like, you know, John Bolton, Mike Pompeo, and what have you, they are more of the, you know, the blood and fire kind of types who want to destroy the nation completely, everyone who is standing in their way, and basically see the destruction all over the place until the United States reigns supreme. But in the end, of course, their goals are similar. Indeed, we have seen aggressive behavior from Democrats like Carter and Bill Clinton and Obama, just as we have seen it from Reagan, Bush, and Trump. This is a cabal, again, to say that word, of a two-headed snake, let's say. These are two sides of the same coin in the United States. Both Democrats and Republicans eventually serve the same interests and have been serving the same interests ever since the country of the United States was founded. This is an issue that has been going on for decades and even centuries. So when you see, you know, Joe Biden take the lead and say, I want to return back to the JCPOA, I want to return back to the negotiation table, we have to be very, very suspicious of their intention, because Joe Biden has said, and that's very important, I believe, he said we want to negotiate back with Iran, but only, and there it comes, of course, if Iran, quote-unquote, keeps strictly to the rules and regulations and the stipulations of the JCPOA. And the problem is that the Americans have shown time and again that their interpretation of what is written in the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action is not necessarily what a normal person, you know, a neutral observer, mm-hmm. would believe that it says. They might use this document in order to pressure and push Iran even further.
And what we've seen, Brad, you were talking about using the JCPO, and we've seen actually Trump talk about this, and others have hinted at it. Again, looking now at the missile technology. And Eric, I want to talk about that, because in these maneuvers that we just saw, one of it was actually Iran flexing its muscles with that missile technology. And there are those who say that even under a Biden administration, that perhaps they're going to try to go after that. Overall, I just want to look at this situation, and where do you think this is all going at this point in time between the United States and Iran?
Well, I don't really agree exactly with Brett or perhaps with you on the fact that there is a cabal and they're all the same in Washington. I think that that was a brave move that Obama made. I don't know why he made it. I think he was trying to get to put Israel in its place because the Stutz worm that was destroying the Iranian nuclear facilities for a while, that was a U.S.-sponsored secret program that was supposed to be under U.S. control, and Israel took it and ran and did what it wanted. So I think that there is a difference, and I think that Biden is a continuation of Obama. He must be aware of all of that background. He's no fool. And I think that I look at this as the same way as when there was detente with the Soviet Union in the 70s, when the U.S. was weak and it made an agreement with the Soviet Union, and it was very positive. It was very positive for the world. It relaxed the tension. And I really hope, and perhaps I'm being too optimistic, but I hope that Biden will fulfill his pledge to return to the program, allow Iran to get its economy back in shape, and to live peacefully in the region with the other people. Iran is not an enemy of Israel. If Israel would just stop being such an aggressive and horrible nation, everyone could make peace with it. So I think that Iran plays a vital role here to stand up to the power and speak the truth. And I really hope that that will happen. I'm trying to be optimistic. We've got a few days before Biden comes to power. Let's hope that he does what he should.
Well, Brett, your take. Eric said basically, obviously you heard him, that he's very optimistic. But what it seems, that if we look again at the more than four decades of the existence of the Islamic Republic of Iran, is that Washington has a problem with Iran being independent and even morally supporting other independent movements. Your take on the future between these two countries now?
Of course, it's very hard to predict, let's say, or to think about what will happen. But I always try, of course, to be, you know, somewhat optimistic myself in regards of what the future might bring. You don't want to look at it too negatively, of course. But I believe that there is a chance that the United States will eventually learn to, you know, leave Iran alone and let Iran, you know, develop its country the way they want to, and develop ties with whatever country they want to, within the axis of resistance, for example, and beyond. And that America will eventually learn how to cope with it, to deal with it. But I believe the only way in which this is possible is by Iran basically building up its capacities for self-defense and its say, its weight in world politics to such an extent that the United States will be forced to recognize the situation as it is. I believe one of the examples I could use for a nation that has in the past faced incredible hostility from the United States and is now considered by the United States as a normal, respectable partner in everyday politics is Vietnam. Of course, I sincerely hope that Iran does not have to go through the terrible tragedy that Iran had to go through for decades in order to get to that position. But it is a fact that the United States was eventually forced, starting in the, you know, mid and late 1970s, to declare that they were basically, that they had been defeated, that their goals, their plans had been foiled, had failed completely due to the resistance and resilience of the Vietnamese. And ever since then, give or take certain disagreements, the United States and Iran and Vietnam are treating each other more or less as equal partners, as just normal nations that conduct diplomacy and trade with one another. Okay. So eventually, if Iran really shows itself to be the strong regional power that they are and that they have every right to be, I believe only that will eventually force the United States to come to the conclusion that they cannot win this policy of maximum pressure anymore.
So resistance and strength is what you said. Thanks so much for being with us, Brett Yonkers, journalist and historian out of Helsinki, and Eric Wahlberg, author and journalist out of Toronto. And thank you for being with us on another debate. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Glad to have you with us. Goodbye.
We are with you. What about you? Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
Trump has come under scrutiny for favoring political allies and well-connected individuals in doling out pardons and commutations. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Brett Samuels, journalist. This article is published under the heading, Trump grants clemency to more than 100 people, including Bannon. Stay tuned for the details, please. Trump on Wednesday, January 20th, granted clemency to more than 100 people in one of his final acts as commander-in-chief, including his former chief strategist, Stephen Bannon. Trump announced a wave of pardons and commutations shortly after midnight on Wednesday, January 20th. Bannon, rapper Lil Wayne, GOP fundraiser Elliot Broidy, and former Detroit mayor Quam Kilpatrick were among the notable figures to receive clemency, along with dozens of lower-profile individuals whose cases were raised by criminal justice reform advocates. Trump granted clemency to 143 individuals in total, just hours before leaving office. 73 received pardons, while 70 were granted commutations. The Bannon pardon was perhaps the most surprising of the batch, given the former Breitbart News editor had a high-profile falling out with the Trump family after de-ingrating Donald Trump Jr. in Michael Wolff's 2018 book, Fire and Fury. Mr. Bannon has been an important leader in the conservative movement and is known for his political acumen. Press Secretary Kayleigh McEnany said in announcing Bannon's pardon. Bannon was a top advisor on Trump's 2016 campaign and served as the chief White House strategist for roughly 7 months. He was arrested and charged last August with defrauding hundreds of thousands of donors who contributed to a fundraising campaign for a private border wall. The president reportedly went back and forth over whether to grant clemency to Bannon before deciding to do so. Trump, who had branded Bannon as Sloppy Steve upon the release of Wolff's book, distanced himself from his former advisor upon news of the charges. "I don't like that project. I thought it was being done for showboating reasons," Trump said at the time. "It was something that I very much felt was inappropriate to be doing." Trump also pardoned Broidy, a former top Republican National Committee, RNC fundraiser, who was charged last year with conspiring to act as an unregistered foreign agent as part of a back-channel effort to lobby the Justice Department. Kilpatrick, the former Democratic mayor of Detroit, was convicted in 2008 of perjury and obstruction of justice, and Lil Wayne faces prison time after pleading guilty to federal gun charges. The rapper, whose birth name is Dwayne Michael Carter Jr., met with Trump on the campaign trail in a meeting campaign later touted as it courted black voters. Trump issued pardons to several individuals who were charged with nonviolent drug offenses, including Tana Logan, Mary Ann Locke, and Caroline Yitz and Alice Johnson, who Trump pardoned and who became a face of the White House's criminal justice reform efforts. Advocated for several of the individuals granted clemency on Wednesday, January 20th. Johnson was among those who advocated for clemency for Kilpatrick as well. Trump has come under scrutiny for favoring political allies and well-connected individuals in doling out pardons and commutations. Past recipients of clemency include ex-Trump campaign chairman Paul Manafort, longtime Trump associate Roger Stone, and ex-Trump national security advisor Michael Flynn. Following his election loss, Trump issued two sizable patches of pardons last month, including those for ex-Republican lawmakers Chris Collins and Duncan Hunter, his former campaign chairman Paul Manafort, longtime friend and advisor Roger Stone, and Charles Kushner, his son-in-law Jared Kushner's father. Trump also pardoned Michael Flynn, his one-time national security advisor, who pleaded guilty to lying to the FBI in connection with the special counsel Robert Mueller's investigation. Some Republicans had before pushed for Trump to pardon WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange or former National Security Agency official Edward Snowden, but neither was given clemency.